Hello, time travelers, and welcome back to another Easter edition of Biblical Time Machine. I am one of your hosts, Dave Roos. I'm a journalist. I'm here with Helen Bond, professor of Christian origins at the University of Edinburgh. Helen, first of all, happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you, too. Did you get some eggs?
We do eggs. We do chocolate. I mean, I'm assuming, like, even over here, those chocolate eggs are Cadbury. So is it also a British tradition over there?
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Cadbury's cream eggs. Cream I know eggs. We probably shouldn't be advertising things, but I do have a weakness for Cadbury's cream eggs. Very nice.
Yeah. I tell you, growing up, I would see those things and I would not understand why anybody would eat them. And I was like, the idea of like a raw egg. I don't know. I almost thought that there was actual like egg inside them. It took me a very long time.
My kids thought that, and it was great because they would not eat them. But now they've found out it's just sugar. They're
cute. All over it. Well, we're gonna try not to ruin Easter for anybody today. I hope we don't. We've taken a similar approach to Christmas and other topics. We're a history podcast, right? So, you know, we're gonna explore these things from a historical perspective. I think what's nice is I don't think we're gonna ruin anybody's Easter, are we, Helen? Like, we're not gonna come to some kind of decision one way or another. It's gonna be up to our listeners to decide.
Yeah, exactly. This is thinking person's discussion on the resurrection.
Yeah. And to do that, we have the perfect guest. So we have Dale Allison. Dale has thought about the resurrection more than any of us combined, more than possibly anybody in the world. Dale is the Richard J. Dearborn Professor of New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary, and he wrote a book just a couple of years ago called The Resurrection of Jesus, Apologetics, Polemics, History. And this is an impressive book. He tracks every argument for or against the sort of historical nature of the resurrection. He weighs them against each other. He does come up with, you know, what he thinks is most likely or not quite as likely. But, you know, he does not give us a straight answer, and we're okay with that. It is worth a read either way, because you're going to come out with your head buzzing and thinking, wow, there's so much more that we could learn about the Bible through history. All right, but now let's get to our fascinating conversation with Dale Allison about the historical nature, or not, of the resurrection. Well, Dale Allison, welcome to Biblical Time Machine.
Thanks so much for having me here today.
All right. So you wrote this terrific book, this sort of exhaustive exploration of all the different angles that we can approach the resurrection sort of historically from a scholarly perspective. But what you do when you start off the book, and I think it's probably smart for us to do when we start this podcast, is kind of set, you know, the reader's expectations. You come out and you say, look, I have not found some kind of smoking gun that either proves or disproves the resurrection. That probably is impossible for us 2,000 years later. But you still went ahead and you wrote this long and very impressive book. So maybe we can start there. Like, you know, yourself as a scholar, you know, as a believing Christian, you know, why was it kind of still worth it for you to dive into this from, you know, so many different angles and explore the topic of the resurrection? If you knew going into it, you're probably not going to have a lot of clear-cut answers at the end.
Well, I'm just curious, and I don't write books once I know what I think about something. I actually write books in order to find out what I think about something. So I had some sense of where I was going, but I remain curious, and I've been curious about this subject my whole life. I remember reading a book by a very famous German theologian named Wolfhart Pannenberg way back in the day when I was a teenager, and he claimed in one of his chapters to show that Jesus rose from the dead. And I remember putting this book down and saying, what the heck did he just do? And I wasn't quite sure what he had just done. He hadn't convinced me, but I wasn't sure why I was not convinced. So I've been curious about this ever since and read everything I can since that time. But I also wrote this book in part because I'm unhappy with some of the arguments that have been put forward by people on, I guess, both sides, because this tends to be a pro-con debate. There are very few people sort of in the middle with, I don't know what to think, I'm undecided. So I wanted to offer criticism of some arguments. And then I also thought I had some new things to say. So there's a whole chapter in there on the strange phenomenon of rainbow bodies in Tibetan Buddhism. And we're not going to have time to talk about that today. But it's really interesting that there is this tradition of holy people whose bodies disappear right after they die, and then they frequently appear to their disciples afterwards. And I thought, well, if this is all bogus, where do the stories come from, and wouldn't that be interesting? And if it's not bogus completely, that's even more interesting. So, I don't know what to think about this, but I just thought, nobody's brought this whole area of discussion into connection with what's going on in New Testament studies. So I thought I had some new things to say. I'm going to stop there, except I want to add something. I did write a book on this subject, but I don't think anybody's an expert on this subject, and I don't want to pretend to be an expert, and I don't want to come off like an expert. I wrote it in part because I was still thinking about things, and I'm still thinking about things now. So that's the nature of the case. I don't know any experts in this field.
That's true. Well, can we start with the basics then? Was there a widespread belief in first century Judaism in some kind of resurrection? And also, was it always bodily? Because people get very sort of hung up on this word bodily, don't they?
Yes, they do. So you've asked a question right off the bat that I can't answer. So what I can say, I think, is that since this belief shows up in the book of Daniel, that people are reading and is fairly popular, it would appear, by the time of Jesus. And because there are passages in Isaiah and the book of Ezekiel that by the turn of the century were understood to prophesy resurrection, and because we're told that the Pharisees believed in resurrection and Jesus and his earliest followers believed in it, then it must have been fairly widespread. But if you want to ask for statistics, I don't think anyone can do that. So did a lot of people? Was it over or under 50%? I don't know how to talk about that. But I do think that even if you didn't believe this or didn't know what to make of it, you probably knew what it was. That is, I think there's enough evidence to say that if you walked around and referred to the resurrection of the dead, people would have some understanding of what you were talking about. So it's a well-known belief, even if it's not the majority belief. Or maybe it was. But, most of the books from antiquity are all gone anyway. And what the people on the street thought, we don't have any interviews with those sorts of people. So I have no idea what percentage of Jews, but I would say it's a fairly well-attested belief.
But that's still a really useful thing, isn't it? I mean, to be clear about the limits of our knowledge. But what about the whole thing about bodily resurrection, though? Because we're always being told that Jews of the first century believed in bodily resurrection. And my reading of Daniel doesn't really support that.
Well, Daniel sounds like astral immortality.
Yeah, they're like stars.
Right? That's sort of what it sounds like. Yeah, you'll become a star when you die. But the truth is, even if I wish it were otherwise, there are lots of texts that are about tombs and dust and bodies. And the rabbis certainly later on have a very physicalist notion of resurrection. There are texts where the bones of the righteous roll through tunnels to pop up on the Mount of Olives. And if you go to the Mount of Olives today, it's covered with graves.
Yeah.
It's because of their reading of a passage in Zechariah that they took very, very literally. So, how these things work, I'm not sure. But maybe in all times and places, you have beliefs and there are different interpretations of them or a spectrum of them. Paul seems to me to be far less literal about bodies than Luke is, for example.
Yeah.
Luke seems to be very physicalist in some way, in some ways. So, yeah, again, we're not going to have one simple answer to this. But again, there is a lot of literalism. You just have to admit it in the ancient texts, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, we're curious about this history because, clearly when you get to the New Testament, we're talking about, what were the expectations versus kind of what happens, right? So to me, it seems striking that in Jesus's case, his resurrection is just him. You know, I'm not saying it's not a great thing, but he comes back. He's resurrected. But my general sense is that if Jewish people were talking about resurrection in the first century, it was kind of everybody, right? It was like in the end of times, everybody gets resurrected. Is that the idea?
Yeah, well, so that's the dominant idea. There are a few texts which raise the question as to whether somebody could speak of an individual being raised apart from the general resurrection. But they're few and far between. In the general sense, and I think the general sense that proclamation of the resurrection of Jesus had in the first place is this is what happens at the end time. So it's only from our point of view, looking back 2,000 years, that we say, oh, this was an isolated event. But I think for the very first Christians, Jesus is the first fruits. And I think the resurrection has started and the end time has begun. And this is part of the fact that they think the end is near. They think the end is so near that events have started, and this is part of them. So if Jesus has risen from the dead, it means that the general resurrection may be near. By the way, I think this has something to do with that very peculiar story in Matthew 27.
Yeah.
Because in Matthew 27, you might remember that Jesus isn't the only one to rise from the dead. Now, it's hard to figure out where exactly this story comes from, which I don't take literally, but it has other people, the holy ones, rising from the dead. And so he's not the only one to do this. And I think this is probably some sort of trace of the early belief that this isn't just by itself or can't be by itself. This is part of the general program at the end.
So we like to think of ourselves as detectives on this time machine that we have. So if we're thinking about Jesus' resurrection, then is all the evidence that we have that we can possibly have in the New Testament itself? Is there anything of use outside the New Testament?
So I think the answer is sadly, regrettably, no. Now, if you had asked me 30 years ago, I think I would have said maybe, because 30 years ago, I actually defended the possibility that something called the Gospel of Peter, which is an apocryphal gospel from the second century, might have some early tradition in it. Sadly, I was convinced I was wrong about this by a friend who criticized me in print. I still wonder sometimes whether parts of this have some independent tradition, but if so, it's not much and we can't do much with it. So I think we really are, regrettably, pretty much stuck with Paul and the Synoptic Gospels and John. So that makes five sources. And it's really horrible that they're all from the same side. I would really like to have Caiaphas's understanding of what the heck happened. Wouldn't that be great?
I'd love of those texts. I mean, you never know. We might find something one day, but
That would be lovely.
Even just Josephus's, you know, unadulterated account of Jesus would be a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and you know, I think that mainstream scholarship is probably right. There probably was a paragraph on Jesus, but it's been rewritten. It probably did refer in some way to their belief he's somehow still alive or his cause goes on. But there aren't any details there, and you can't do anything with it. And he's just getting his story from what people are saying about Christians, you know, in the last half of the first century. He's not some witness there in Jerusalem in AD 30 or 33. I used to say AD 30 or 33, and then I read some article by you, I think, Helen, in which you made me think, well, maybe we can't be certain of these two dates. Anyway, somewhere around there.
It's one of those articles that just says we know less than we thought we knew.
Yes, that's right.
Which is
right.
Not very helpful.
No, it makes my life harder.
All right, so if the evidence that we have is all contained within the New Testament, then let's get to some of the arguments. The arguments, you know, well, I guess we'll start with the arguments against the historical nature of Jesus's resurrection. So I got to imagine the big one that anyone would bring up is just basically you can't be resurrected. That's not, you know, people die. That's where they stay. They don't come back. So this is sort of the scientific approach, which you could level against any of the miracles in any biblical text that these things don't happen. But you taking, you know, as a historian or approaching this from a historical angle, can you say anything to those kind of arguments? Like, these things don't happen.
I think I can, although you need to keep in mind that my views here are horrifically idiosyncratic. And since they are idiosyncratic, they're almost certainly incorrect. But my view is that the world is a very strange place. Mm. It's a very, very strange place. I think there are some historical events which are far better attested than the resurrection of Jesus, which remain inexplicable within our current categories, our scientific understanding, and so on. So there's one chapter in that book on the so-called Marian apparitions in Zaytun, Egypt in the late 60s. I've spent a lot of time on this subject. I've talked to a lot of people. I don't think there's any explanation for this. This is a weird, truly weird event. And I just think it was a... So over the course of a year, there was a light figure, an apparition, which appeared outside of St. Mary's Church. It's a Coptic Orthodox church in Zaytun, which is a suburb of Cairo. And people saw it, and it would move around a little bit, and there would be these lights that would circle it that they called doves. And the weird thing about this is that this was seen by literally hundreds of thousands of people over a period of months. There are photographs of the things, and all the Coptic Christians around the world think of this as a major religious event in their time. And if you talk to anybody who was there, they think they saw Mary. But Muslims were there, and they saw Mary. And then there are reports from secular journalists who were there, and they don't know what this is, but they know it's a something. And it was investigated at the time, and the city of Cairo actually shut down the electrical grid to the area to make sure that, you know, this wasn't some sort of electrical trick. Anyway, the skeptical explanations for this are ridiculous in my mind. They make no sense. And I'm just stuck with that's really fascinating. So I think there are a few things like this. I also, again, I'm idiosyncratic, and I hope I don't offend you too much, but I think the evidence that a 17th century Italian saint named Joseph of Copertino, the evidence that this guy levitated again and again and again over a period of 30 years in various times and places, seen by tons and tons and tons of people, it's actually overwhelming. And if this were anything other than levitation, which can't happen, nobody would seriously doubt this. So I also think people sometimes see the future. I think sometimes people don't just hallucinate the dead, but actually have encounters with the dead. So all of that, by the way, of saying my worldview is really strange. That doesn't mean that the miracles of the New Testament happened, but it does mean I hold a worldview in which it's easier to think about the possibility of weird things. So the way I think about it, which doesn't sound very Christian, is the weirder your worldview is, the easier it is to accept the weird stuff in the New Testament. Now, that's not theology. I'm just talking here as an historian and a person who thinks that sometimes human testimony is not worthless. And sometimes you can add things up and say, oh, I think this happened, and it's really remarkable. So I don't see how to go back and decide, oh, I can show Jesus rose from the dead. But I do think there are reasons you can give for holding a worldview which is stranger or weirder than many people hold. And so that's how I would approach this. So you can see this in the book when I come to Tibetan Rainbow Bodies. I just say, I honestly don't know what to think. Now, if I were a certain sort of person, I would say, I'm a Christian. I know this can't happen because it's not my religion. Or I could say, I'm a skeptic, and I know things like this don't happen because things like this don't happen. So what a bunch of nonsense. I actually looked at it and said, I have no idea. Maybe this is happening. Maybe it's not. For me, it's just a question of testimony and so on. It's such an interesting phenomenon. I'll stop here. But it's still going on. It's still going on. Two of these have happened in the last 25 years.
Wow.
Where Tibetans are reported that, you know, so-and-so we put him in his little thing and he disappeared in 3 days.
I'm going to Google them straight away. And what about some of the other sort of skeptical arguments? You know, I mean, what one of them is as old as Matthew's gospel, isn't it? That the disciples came and stole the body. You know, this is all over the internet every Easter with people sort of finding ways in which the tomb was empty. What do you think about those arguments?
So I'm somebody who is not a favorite of the skeptics, and I'm not a favorite of the apologists, because I think that you can read the evidence both ways and that the evidence itself doesn't dictate its own interpretation. So if I were a skeptic, which I'm not, but if I were a skeptic, I would say Jesus' body was probably stolen. I think that's the easiest thing to do. Now, there are other skeptical stances, such as there was no empty tomb, he wasn't buried, and so on. But I think the most plausible skeptical scenario would say, yes, he was buried, and that his tomb was robbed. People took the body. And as you know, Helen, there are lots of stories in novels about people stealing bodies for magical purposes or recipes. Or if you read the magical papyri, there are actually recipes that require pieces from dead bodies or a piece of someone who died violently, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So as weird as it sounds, there seems to have been a business, right, in stealing bodies. And if I were a skeptic, I'd say this explains why it happened at night, because it was against the law. This explains why the stone is rolled away, because they were in a hurry. They didn't want to be caught, and so on. So I don't see how to eliminate that. And if I were a skeptic, I'd say, sure, why not? Now, the Christian response to that is always, well, that's very improbable, right? Very improbable. But the skeptic's response is, well, it's more probable than somebody rising from the dead, correct? So, it depends how you're looking at that. But again, I've gotten in trouble here because I think this is a possibility from the skeptic's point of view. And as a Christian, it's supposed to be my duty to refute every other option, but I don't. I don't see how to do that. So for me, for example, the apparitions at Zaytun, Egypt, I mean, we literally have firsthand testimony from thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And we actually have some photographic evidence. We have firsthand journalistic accounts. Even with all that, I say, I don't know what this is. So if that's the case with some modern event that happened in my lifetime, it seems odd that I could go back 2,000 years with just the Christian sources and somehow prove to everybody's satisfaction that scenario A is the only one that holds water. That seems odd to me. We're often expecting way too much of historians. One of my favorite quotes is from Origen, who says, one of the hardest things to do is to prove that something happened, even if it did.
And isn't it a little bit to do with faith as well?
Yeah. Anyway, so.
Well, something you mentioned a minute ago, you talked about the idea of people seeing and interacting with, you know, deceased loved ones. This is a very common and written about phenomenon, maybe something else that you would point to and say, I don't know what's going on here, but there seems to be something going on. So is that sort of another, you know, semi-skeptical argument you can make against Jesus's resurrection, that maybe it wasn't, you know, a bodily resurrection, but maybe they were, you know, Jesus's apostles and other people were having more of a vision, you know, a sort of a spiritual vision of the resurrected Jesus. What do you say to that that line of thinking?
Okay, so that's a really extremely complicated question, which is why there are two whole chapters on it in this book, two very, very long chapters. Now, first of all, if you say that the disciples saw Jesus or thought they saw Jesus, you could interpret that in two different ways. You could say they really did encounter Jesus, or they just hallucinated him. So in my view, not all visions are purely endogenous. I think some that is self-generated, or they're just projection. I think some apparitions are responses to incoming data. Now, I also think there are various types of apparitions, and there's a phenomenology of apparitions here. But my own view is that these accounts sound to me, the ones that are in the gospel, sound to me like they are descended from visionary or visionary-like experiences. So even in the Gospel of John, where Thomas, you know, is invited to touch Jesus, it sounds like Jesus pops in and pops out, which is not the ordinary thing. And even in Matthew, where you have an empty tomb and the body is gone, it's so interesting that the body is gone before the tomb is opened. If you read the first few verses of Matthew 28 very carefully, it's not like the Gospel of Peter where they roll away the stone and Jesus comes out. He's already gone, which means unless there's a back door, he's somehow gone into another dimension, or he's gone through the stone or something really weird. These stories also frequently come with a motif of doubt. This is really interesting that this is somehow remembered. I think it's original. There's also more than one story where people don't recognize who he is.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. So I actually, in the book, come up with a list of quite a number of characteristics of these of what's going on in the Gospels that match apparitional experiences or encounters with the dead. So you can look at that and say, well, that's a reason to be skeptical. But since, again, I'm idiosyncratic, I think some encounters with dead loved ones are actually not purely subjective. I also have had a couple of these myself. I guess I can say that on the air, right? I had a dead person show up and at the end of my bed 3 days after she died, woke me up and, you know, that doesn't mean anything to anybody else, but it was utterly, totally real at the time. Wow. And all these years later, it's still really hard for me to think I just sort of made this up. Mm. This person also several weeks later came and told me to do something. So I just have this strange worldview in which veridical apparitions would fit perfectly. And again, I think this fits a lot of the New Testament evidence, because I think there's a tendency for apologetical reasons to try to make things as concretely as possible, as concrete as possible. But I still see these things that don't sound very concrete to me, like a body disappearing without leaving the exit, right? Or just popping in, or people wondering, are you really, really this person? I had one more thing, then I will shut up on this question. But if you look at the phenomenology of apparitions, you will discover that most of them are not like ghosts. That is, most apparitions are not see-through insubstantial things. Most apparitions actually look exactly like real people. Mm. And sometimes they get touched, whatever the explanation of that is. Sometimes they seem totally real. And I've actually found some testimonies from people who said, you know, I was in bed, my dead husband came, and it was just like Jesus and the disciples. Wow. You know, I could touch him, and so on and so on. So, wow. So you got to be careful that if you say apparition, it doesn't mean necessarily some sort of Casper-like see-through ethereal nothingness. Most of them really are just—they just look like you and me.
Mm-hmm. So much of this sort of goes back to the idea of the tomb being empty, doesn't it? The empty tomb is kind of like the big symbol, I suppose, of all of this. But how much historical weight do you give to this Joseph of Arimathea story? And, you know, because he does change quite a lot throughout the tradition. So do you think...
Who
do you think he was? And what do you make of that story?
Well, you know, he eventually founds the Church of England, right?
He comes to Britain, doesn't he, with Jesus as a boy. Yeah. And wasn't he supposed to be the uncle of Jesus, I think, in some...
And he's got the Holy Grail. You're right.
The Holy Grail.
you're right. These legends grow, and they're fascinating to watch, because the further we get from Joseph, the more we know about him, right?
Yeah.
And the more stories we get. But in the book, I argued that the burial is probably historical. I guess I would say that I think the preponderance of the evidence points this way. Paul already says in 1 Corinthians 15, in that pre-Pauline confession, that Jesus was buried. All four synoptics have Jesus buried. Josephus says that the Romans, at least in time of peace, let people bury even crucifixion victims. And if you've been to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, you've seen that little cabinet where they actually have somebody who was crucified, and he was in an ossuary, which means they allowed burial, right? So for me, I know that the Romans typically wanted bodies to be left hung up or to be tossed into piles. But when it comes to the New Testament, I think that the evidence is in favor of there being some sort of burial. Now, whether it's by somebody who's working on behalf of the Sanhedrin, that is, they're, you know, this is just what you do, and instead of putting him in the criminal's grave, he puts him in his own because he's run out of time. All these sorts of questions, I don't know how to answer, but I think there's got to be a kernel of truth here. And the way I think about it is like this. I think that there probably was a group of women that went from Galilee to Jerusalem with Jesus. I also think that some of them probably saw his execution. I think that they had less reason to be afraid or to run away than the men did, given the culture, the time and place. And if they witnessed the crucifixion, I'm pretty sure they would have witnessed the burial. Why not? They would have been interested in their loved one, and it would have been in the vicinity very near anyway. Jerusalem's very tiny place. And, you know, if you've been to Jerusalem today, the site that's identified as Golgotha, right, is, you know, it's in the same building, right, as where the tomb is. And whether those are the right places, I think it probably was something like that. It's a very short distance. And so I think if they were there, they would have witnessed the crucifixion, and then they would have witnessed the burial. And if they had done that, they would have gone back to mourn. That's what people do. People go to graves and mourn and think about the dead and so on. So I see no reason to think that they wouldn't have done that. It also works the other way. So if they were there and a tomb was empty, then they knew where the tomb was, which means they would have had to see the burial somehow. And if they had seen the burial, it's probably because they were at the crucifixion and saw it happen. So I think it fits together fairly nicely. But I'm not dogmatic about it. And let me add as a footnote, I don't know what to do with this theologically. I'm not like many evangelicals who have to have an empty tomb. For me, a life beyond this one doesn't have anything to do with bodies, right? And so why it should be so different in Jesus's case is not something that, is obvious to me. Mm. So for me, the empty grave is, as an historian, I say it's more probable than not, but that's it. It's over the 50-50 line. But theologically, I don't know what to make of it.
Well, yeah, something you mentioned there, and I think it does kind of push this into maybe more probable territory. Like if you want to approach the story from a completely skeptical view and you're like, they made this up from whole cloth, you would think, you know, given the time and the place, that they would have, you know, the male disciples be the ones to discover the empty tomb, and the male disciples be the ones who would first see Jesus, the resurrected Jesus. So is that some kind of evidence to you that it is all the women who kind of what's the word I'm looking for? You know, they get the first glimpse of the resurrected Jesus?
Yeah. So it doesn't prove anything, but I think it... It points more to, let's say, a conservative side than a skeptical side. I do think it would be, it's not expected that this story would be centered on the women. So many arguments that apologists put forward having to do with the women don't hold up. They'll say things like women could never testify in court, and that's just not true. Mm-hmm. We do have some texts where women are speaking in legal contexts, and that includes the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are pre-Christian texts. Nonetheless, it seems to me that Luke and John are really anxious to bring the boys onto the scene, right? And it just fits that the women would be going there to mourn. I think it's a decent argument. How about that? Okay. It's a decent argument. It's not a knockdown argument, but I think it's more likely than not. Again, if you look at the Gospels, feminist biblical critics since, what, especially the 90s, have taught us an awful lot about women in Jesus, women in the Gospels, and written tons of books and articles, and so on. And it really is the case that women are there. Women are there a lot more than the texts say. Mm-hmm. They are in the background. And I think it is unusual for them to come forward like this. Now, the usual skeptical response to what I just said is, well, everybody knew the disciples weren't there, so they had to make up a male disciple. So they had to make up a story, and they went and got the women. But I'm thinking, if they made up a story because people didn't know the facts, might as well just bring Peter and James, John and whatever there, which is actually what happens in the Gospel of John. So why not just do that from the beginning? Why bring them on as though you're sort of respecting the historical facts, but you're not respecting them? So I don't think that's a good counter.
And what do you make of the preaching in Acts? I mean, I know that's a whole new can of worms, you know, how accurate is what Acts says about early Christian preaching. But presumably some of it at some level must have been about Jesus' resurrection. And how could early Christians have proclaimed Jesus' resurrection if you know, it was widely known that the body was still there?
So maybe that argument works. I've gotten in trouble for saying I don't know whether this argument works or not. Okay, so I'm back to I don't know this much. So first of all, I would say that if you're talking about the religious leaders, people in the Sanhedrin or so, or, you know, people like that, they don't know right after Jesus has been crucified, or even weeks thereafter, or even months thereafter, or even years thereafter, that this is on its way to becoming a world religion. It's probably something they don't take very seriously. And if, you know, somebody were to tell me that half a mile away, somebody rose from the dead last night, I probably wouldn't go and visit, because I just wouldn't take it seriously, right? So are people taking these people seriously? And certainly, they're not going to take them seriously until there's some sort of big public commotion, which at least according to Acts doesn't take place for several weeks, right? So what are they going to do at that point? Let's say that they actually went to the tomb and pulled some body out. I don't think it would have mattered at that point, because everybody would have said, or the followers of Jesus would have said, well, that's not him. I mean, it would have been, you know, kind of rotted by then, even if they did. Or they would have said, you just got somebody, so, you know, to try to stop it. But there's actually no record of this. Mm-hmm. And I also think that if opponents had gone to the tomb and anybody knew about this, there would be some story. Anyway, there's no record of this. I don't know how seriously people are taking this. So I don't know. And I don't know what you do after a body's been sitting there rotting for weeks and weeks. You know, these people aren't embalmed.
And the tomb, right? The tomb of Jesus never becomes a site of, as far as we know, a site of Christian pilgrimage. Do you think that has anything to do with it, or do we just not have enough information about whether that
That argument works both ways. So skeptics will bring this up and they'll say that's a reason for not thinking there was an empty tomb, because it would have been a holy site. And then the apologists say, well, it proves that the tomb was empty, because if it hadn't been empty, they would have made it into a holy site. So it wasn't a holy site. So that's one of those one datum that can go either way. And since it could go either way, it doesn't seem to me to do anything.
Wow. So, you know, this is Easter season. Christians around the world are pondering these events. Jesus' resurrection clearly cornerstone of Christianity. Here we are 2,000 years later, as we've discussed, we're looking back, we're trying to decide from a little bit more removed, you know, could this have happened? Did this happen? You know, do you think that we will ever get to the bottom of this in a satisfactory way, or will it just come down, like you said, to your sort of your individual worldview?
Yeah. There's no we. There's no we. Mm. So there will always be skeptics, and there will always be people who belong to other religions who don't want Jesus to rise from the dead, so they won't believe it. There will probably always be apologists who think they can demonstrate it, or at least make it highly probable. Then you will also have tons of people who will simply say, well, I know this by faith. I don't need to worry about the historians or the apologists, and so on. So you'll always have these people. I am relatively happy with what I think at this point in time, but my book is just, here are some thoughts. I'm letting them go. If anybody wants to read this and respond, that's fine. Maybe it'll contribute to the conversation. But I don't think my work or anybody else's work is going to change the landscape, right? And when you talk to people in the pews, most of them don't care a lot about this. They really don't. And I'm not sure what they always mean by it, but they'll just say, you know, I believe, or I know Jesus lives in my heart, or something like that. And, you know, when they say Christ is risen, they're not saying, well, I've done all the investigative work, and after years of thinking, I've decided, yes, Jesus rose from the dead. They're never doing that. So they mean something else. So I think this is a fascinating topic from an historical point of view. It's also fascinating from a philosophical and theological point of view. But it's just one of those discussions that's going to go on and on and on, I think, you know, unless we have something new. I think the data can be interpreted or construed in more than one way. And sometimes I think of, you know, one of those interpretations of quantum mechanics, which says the observer collapses the wave function, is kind of like the observer organizes the data and puts the story on it, right? But the data is so sparse in so many ways that you can, I think, honestly read more than one way. Mm. So for me, the resurrection isn't the epistemological center of Christianity, by which I mean it's not an epistemological foundation from which you can build everything else. I think it's part of the Christian universe, and it's interpreted then in terms of what else is in your worldview or in your theological system or lack of system or whatnot. The problem is to try to get too much out of it as an historical proof. I don't think that can be done.
But that's what's so important about your book, actually, that you sort of give permission for people to say, look, I just don't really know. You know, there's evidence both ways, and it's okay to say, I don't really know. You don't have to have a clear-cut position, and you don't have to defend it to the death.
Yeah, but I know lots of people who don't feel that way and are very insecure with this. And maybe it has something to do with my mother and how I was raised. All I can say is, I don't need historical certainty for all sorts of things.
All right. Well, we're going to give you a chance here to have some historical certainty if you choose. We have a time machine. It is amazing. I'm not going to give away all the secrets that we've discovered. That's a whole different podcast. But where and when would you like to travel? I want to say it's got to be there at the tomb, but maybe you have something else.
No. Well, so you gave me this question ahead of time, and I thought about it, and you won't like my. So I got two answers. All right, I have two answers, not one. My first answer is I would go back in time to about 1980, and I would meet with my father. I would convince him I'm a time traveler, and I would say, Dad, a couple of decisions that you are about to make will cause catastrophe for you and a bunch of other people. Don't do this. Mm. So he was an open-minded person, kind of like me. That's where I get some of my idiosyncratic ideas about the weirdness of the world. He would have said, okay, son, you've convinced me. You're a time traveler. We're going to do something different. But Here's what I would like to do. I would like to go back to Jerusalem in about AD 35. So this is afterwards. And what I am so interested in, and of course frustrated that I'll never have the answers to, I really want to know what Christianity or the Jesus movement, whatever you want to call it, I want to know what it was like before Paul and apart from Paul. Mm-hmm. Because we see everything through Paul and Acts. Yeah. And Luke, of course, is a Paulinist. He knows Paul. He likes Paul. Paul's a hero. I would like to know really, what, apart from Paul, is going on with James and Peter and these other people? I'd like to interview with Stephen. What is your theology? I'd really love to do that. So that's my wish. If I can't go see my late father, then I'd like to go back and figure out the earliest, right? Jesus, post-Easter Jesus movement. I'm really interested in this. Most of my colleagues are in love with Paul. I'm in love with Jesus more than Paul. And I think I would be in love with this thing in the middle, but I don't know exactly what it is.
Well, that's perfect. We will take you there. It doesn't have to be a wish anymore, Dale. We're going to make this possible.
Okay.
We'll send you an email. It could be a few years, very long waiting list, but we'll let you know when it's your turn. Dale, Allison, thank you so much for being here. This is a wonderful exploration of a very important topic. I hope our listeners are as curious as you and want to kind of know more from every angle. Of course, if they want to really take a deep dive, they should get your book. So the book, again, is called The Resurrection of Jesus, Apologetics, Polemics, History. And that came out, that's a fresh one. That came out just in 2021. So go out and get the book. But for now, this has been another episode of Biblical Time Machine, and we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye. If you've enjoyed this episode, it's really helpful for us if you can rate and review us on your podcast provider. It'll help other listeners to find us more easily. Thank you.